Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Sold into Slavery, we report on an upcoming conference at the Vatican where the Church will discuss how to use its global networks to step up the fight against the scourge of human trafficking. Searching for Peace. The Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences discussed the new signs of the times affecting the tranquility of order in today's world. And we find out more. And Swiss Guard Anniversary. We revisit the institution of the Swiss Guards ahead of this weekend's swearing-in ceremony for new recruits on the anniversary of their greatest sacrifice. It's the second most profitable worldwide criminal enterprise after the illegal arms trade. We're talking about human trafficking, where men, women and children are bought and sold every day. In countries across the globe, these victims are transported and sold into modern-day slavery, whether for the sex trade, domestic servitude or for forced labour. So how can the Catholic Church use its global networks to help fight the scourge of human trafficking? That's one of the key aims behind a conference on combating human trafficking that has been hosted next week by the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. The key organiser of the conference is Bishop Patrick Lynch, who heads the Church's Office for Migration in England and Wales. He told me more about it.
Well, it's significant for two reasons. First of all, because it is an attempt to bring together NGOs, law enforcement agencies, bishops, religious who are working in the field of trafficking from throughout the world, but especially those countries who are connected because of the trafficking issue and the trafficking problem. And it's an opportunity together to look at ways as to how we can make people aware of this tragedy of human trafficking, but also to reflect on how perhaps we can in the future cooperate together, communicate together and work together to avoid this and to come to terms with this problem.
Are you seeking a more hands-on approach through this conference? Because you say you're forging partnerships with law enforcement agencies, who after all are the people on the front line of trying to stop this evil trade by catching the criminals responsible for it.
Well, the three themes that will run through the day would be prevention, pastoral care and reintegration. And those are three fundamental themes where people have to work together. I think, secondly, because it is with the law enforcement agencies, it becomes very practical in the sense of we must build together in different countries and across national boundaries and international boundaries a trust and a communication with and regarding all issues regarding trafficking. I think that is different. I think it's also different in the sense that we have people from Eastern Europe, with people from Asia, from Africa, here in Great Britain and different parts of Europe.
How active is the Church on this anti-human trafficking front now compared to, say, 10 years ago? And does this extend right down to the parish level?
I think throughout the world, one of the groups that has led the way and been a shining example in responding to the problem of trafficking has been the Religious Institutes of Women. Throughout the world, they have taken the lead. Also, I think in more recent years, different organisations, peace and justice groups, different parishes, have also become aware of the problems. I think in parish levels, certainly parishes who would be in an inner city have come across different situations where someone is trafficked. And I think what we're now aware of is that we have to work together not just different agencies within the church, but actually with law enforcement officers, NGOs, and different other organizations, first of all to prevent it, and then to actually give practical help to people who have been trafficked.
So can you give us some examples of how the department that you head actively helps, you know, on this sort of practical, hands-on approach level?
Well, the first thing you would encourage people to do is to be aware. In other words, to be aware in a large inner city parish that you may well have people who sneak into the back of the church, perhaps say a few prayers or go and light a candle, that there will be people, may well be people who have actually had the experience of being trafficked. So be aware and be sensitive to those people. Secondly, give them a welcome. Take the first step. Go and talk to them. Even if they don't speak the language, find out someone who can communicate them. So instead of leaving them on the fringes of the community, help to bring them in and make them part of the community. But then, very importantly, be informed. Be informed as to the ways that you can help them. There is a helpline that the Metropolitan Police have available. That is one source of very good help. There are other groups within the church here in England where people are very skilled at dealing with the personal issues that surge to the surface of someone who has been trafficked. And then the last thing would be to help maybe stay with people, because when people have an issue or have been trafficked, the one thing they need is some consistent person to walk with them and accompany them in their journey and in their struggle. So there'd be four areas that people in parishes could certainly work with.
Presumably you have met personally some victims of human trafficking. And if so, what struck you most about their experience? And would you like to share very briefly with us the story of one of them that struck you as particularly inspirational?
Well, I think the first time I came across people who were trafficked was many years ago in Japan. I was visiting a number of missionaries there who were working in a number of big cities. And remember, in Japan, the Catholic population is very, very small. And there was a number of Filipino women who had obviously been trafficked. Now, they didn't use that word, but they would have come to the different Catholic churches for consolation, for support, actually to nourish their faith in very different circumstances. The second thing that very often comes from those who are trafficked is they're away from home. They're away from their family. So they have none of their family near or nearby. So in a sense, when they come to the priest, they share themselves at a very profound level because they have no one else they can trust. However, the next thing that has to happen is to make a real difference. The pastoral worker or priest or sister needs help from an organization like the Metropolitan Police, maybe like the Women at the Well, or maybe like the Madai Trust, to actually bring the case a little bit further so that they can find a way out of the trap situation that they're in.
I was speaking to Bishop Patrick Lynch, who heads the Office for Migration at the Catholic Church of England and Wales. Forgiveness and justice are both needed to resolve conflicts and bring about peace. That was the core of the message given by Pope Benedict when he addressed delegates this week, attending the plenary assembly of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences. The theme they were discussing during their five-day meeting was the global quest for tranquility and order. This was taken from Pope John XXIII's encyclical letter Pacem in Terris, which is coming up to its 50th anniversary. Among the delegates at the meeting of the Academy of Sciences was Professor Russell Hittinger, who heads the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of Tulsa in the US. So, in his view, how deep a relevance do the themes contained in the papal encyclical Pacem in Terris still have? And what are the new signs of the times emerging which affect the tranquility of order in today's world?
When John XXIII decided to issue this encyclical, he ordered his drafting team to thematize the entire encyclical around St. Augustine's concept of peace as tranquillitas ordinis, tranquility of order. And so we have been looking at a very rich and complicated set of orders that are emerging today in early 21st century. Some of the most important questions, well, first of all, would have to do with Europe. I mean, the entire world is watching the European nations groping toward some kind of adequate order among themselves. And, of course, if the Europeans can't have a tranquility of order, who else can? Because the Europeans have been trying to do it ever since the Second World War. So that's a very important issue that we keep on coming back to and discussing. We are discussing the emergence of China and India and Southeast Asia as maybe the chief economic player in the world within our lifetime. That is really different than 50 years ago when Pope John issued the encyclical. They would have been regarded as third world countries. Today, they are first world economies.
Professor Hittinger says new forms of communications were another issue on the agenda at the meeting, along with education and the role of religion.
We are, especially today, paying a lot of attention to the emergence of global communications, which seems to be changing almost every kind of order we're familiar with. It's changing the order of scientific research, communication between peoples in different countries. It's intimately bound up with political revolutions, and this is new, so we're having to try to understand it. We have also been spending quite a bit of time with what education means, moral education, religious education, within the context of education without national boundaries. So a family in Cleveland, Ohio, has children that are being formed by an internet exactly the same as in Perugia in Italy. Because up until our generation, almost all education was done within the context of national education, public schools in France and in Italy, the United States. And these boundaries are breaking down, and no one is quite sure what this means and where the opportunities are. Finally, we have been spending a lot of time looking at the role of religion as an agent of peace and tranquility. And of course, that's not always so in the world. But we're trying to understand what religious traditions can do to foster this complex kind of multi-layered peace that people seem to want.
Information and education are far more accessible to all now, largely thanks to the internet. But at the same time, human beings, and especially the authorities, have far less control over the process. So does Hittinger agree that the role of authority is weakened because of this? And if so, can anything be done to correct this?
Well, everyone understands now that parents' traditional academic curricula is taught in universities, the teaching authority of churches and religious bodies are all, in one sense, weakened by global communications. Because in global communications, there's no apparent authority at all. On the other hand, no one wants to address this problem the way the government of China sometimes does, which is to erect national filters on the communication of information either. So to figure out what is the sweet spot between controlling global communications and restricting freedom, and on the other hand, a kind of almost anarchical diffusion of knowledge, this is still to be understood. This is a work in progress, and probably no one has an absolute answer to that right now.
Looking at political developments and the global financial situation and Europe's role on the world stage, how dominant is this role? Professor Hittinger again.
Now, I don't think anyone believes that the European nations are going to be the absolute leader, either militarily or even economically, but the ability of Europeans to achieve a workable harmony between themselves and to transcend the original agreement, which was only about currency, everyone's watching because it's going to be an example for everyone else. Latin America, Southeast Asia, other regions of the world in which a plurality of nations have to figure out a harmony that's not just monetary and financial.
So, should Europe review its moral leadership? And in particular, does Hittinger think it reacted in the right way to the Arab Spring uprisings?
Well, this is an interesting question, because I'm not sure anyone quite knows what the answer to this is, because the springtime in the Arab world, politically, is still only a springtime, and we don't know even a year from now what's going to be the result. So it's very difficult to give an instant opinion about that. But we do have some earlier examples where the Europeans were extremely successful. 1989, there was a bloodless revolution that affected, 100 million people. And that's not even counting Germany. So in 1989 began a process that was able to be completed without any drops of blood. And it seemed to me that the nations of Europe played it just right. They let it evolve, they encouraged it, and they politically welcomed the East, the central and eastern part of Europe, back into the community of nations, and did so in just the right way. After about 4 or 5 years, the whole thing was complete. It was brilliant.
So, to sum up, are the principles expounded in the encyclical Pacem in Terris still a valid reference point in today's world? Professor Hittinger again.
Yes, Pacem in Terris, 50 years later, is still a work in progress.
That was Professor Russell Hittinger of the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of Tulsa in the U.S. Another of the participants at the meeting of the Academy was Lord David Alton, a leading Catholic peer at Britain's House of Lords. I caught up with him during the meeting and began by asking him about the enduring relevance of Pope John XXIII's encyclical Pacem in Terris, nearly half a century after its release.
It's a fascinating statement. It was often described as John XXIII's last will and testament, and it was certainly shaped by his experiences. I referred during the conference to the role that he played when he was in Bulgaria, but also in Istanbul, and the personal interaction he had with the victims of the Nazi Holocaust. He helped many Jewish people, of course, to flee to Israel, but he also met many of those who had been victims of the Armenian Genocide. So all of that shaped his view about the sanctity of human life, about how people are made in the image of God. And that gave rise, I think, to this extraordinary document, which is about human rights. It's about how people are respected in the world in which we live today. And today's conference is looking at where we are 50 years later and what application that has in these more troubled times.
Yes, you talked about applications. I mean, it's looking at the new truths and the issues and the problems which affect the tranquility of order or peace in today's globalized world. What, in your view, are some of the greatest threats to the peace or tranquility of order nowadays?
I think that the subjectivity that we have today, the relativism that says and demands, I can have my truth, you can have yours, can reduce many issues just to a matter of choice rather than an absolute. And there are some things that are absolute. The sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, is not something that's open to negotiation or amendment. And when you consider the scourge of abortion, of euthanasia, experiments on human embryos, the cloning of human beings, but also the extraordinary scale of massive poverty that demeans and diminishes human dignity in the world today, 800 million people racked by starvation or despair, living below any definition of rational human decency, the challenges are clearly enormous. And that is why the Church, while not being a political authority, has to, in every generation, lay down the principles for political and public discourse.
You were discussing truth, justice, charity and liberty in the globalized world in your intervention. What were the main examples you were using to support your argumentation on these concepts?
I was looking at a whole series of issues, the first of which was how we practice politics And I was arguing that in the end, I would agree with Tip O'Neill, the late Speaker of Congress, who said that ultimately all politics is local. And I think that we've seen a lot of alienation in public and political life, not least in the United Kingdom, where people have become disassociated from the political processes, and we have to reclaim that ground, a connectedness, if you like. I was challenging also the idea that just creating supranational organisations is in some way a solution to our problems. Interconnectedness is crucial, but we have to do things at an intimate and local level. So I was very approving of the ideas of personalism, communitarianism, localism. These ideas, I think, are important in the way that we construct society in the future. But I also reflected on my own experiences as both someone who's been in academic life but also involved in politics now for over 30 years, and having started my own life in the inner city of Liverpool, working in deprived neighbourhoods and communities, that we must always be on the side of justice. So the theme of my own talk was Truth, Justice, Charity and Liberty in the Globalised World. And that, of course, was the subtitle of the encyclical Parchment Terrace.
Religious freedom is another of the recurring themes. Do you see new threats to this in many countries where previously this was not a big issue? Not least perhaps because of the growing secularisation, perhaps hostility towards overt forms of showing one's religious faith in the public sphere.
I raised a number of examples in my remarks, not least the attacks, for instance, in the United Kingdom on people saying prayers in public places or the wearing of a cross. These are, at the very minimum, irritants. But I also went on to talk about some of the depredations that occur all over the globe in the name both of atheism and indeed of other religions. And in a recent report published in the United States, it identified the 16 worst offenders in terms of the countries which carry out such attacks on Christian believers. And it is significant that although other faiths suffer too, the only faith that was attacked in every one of those 16 countries was the Christian faith. I gave specifically the example of Shahbaz Bharti, the Pakistan Minister for Minorities, who just over a year ago was assassinated because he had stood up for the idea of a plural society which respects tolerance.
What about the question of ethics? You know, we're in the midst of this global financial crisis, and a lot of people are saying it's a crisis of morality, ethics. There was some very rash and unscrupulous ways of doing business, and now it seems to be a lot of the ordinary, the poor people who are suffering. Do you get the feeling that social inequality is increasing nowadays, as many claim?
I'm sure social inequality has been increasing, and I often think when I ride on the London Underground, the tube, and hear the warning, you should mind the gap as you get on and off the train, but that's something that government should do as well, is to mind the gap. We live in the United Kingdom, and I guess it's true in many other parts of the world, in a sharp-elbowed society where you do unto others before they do you. You grab whatever you can, take whatever you like, trample on whoever you want, sort of parody of the gospel message. And it's extraordinary some of the things now that are being promulgated in the name of both philosophy and ethics. A group of so-called ethicists at Oxford University recently, for instance, redefined infanticide as after-birth abortion, purely on the basis that it would be legitimate to abort a baby after birth if, for instance, it had Down syndrome or another disability, even though that baby had been born alive, because they argued that if you hadn't done the tests in advance and detected these things, it gave you legitimacy in taking the life of that child. So these are real issues that come before us, and why we need to put them in the context of the Church's teaching on the dignity of the human person and the belief that we are all, each of us, sacred because we are made in the image of God, and that our human lives have to be upheld from the moment of conception to natural death.
I was speaking to Lord David Alton, a Catholic peer in Britain's House of Lords. Numbering just over 100 men, the Vatican's Swiss Guard are members of the oldest standing army in the world, and are probably the smallest one. Although they have now a largely ceremonial role, the Swiss Guards are part of an elite force that is ready at any moment to sacrifice their lives for the Pope. It was in 1506 that 150 Swiss soldiers first entered the Vatican by request of Pope Julius II to form the Pontifical Swiss Guard. Nowadays, they are responsible for guarding entrances to the Vatican and the entire papal residence. In collaboration with other Vatican security forces, they ensure the Pope's personal safety anywhere he might go. The force's greatest sacrifice came on May the 6th, 1527, when 147 Swiss guards lost their lives defending Pope Clement VII during the sack of Rome. Only 42 guards survived that bloody attack, but the Pope himself was able to escape to safety through a secret passageway running from the Vatican to the Castel Sant'Angelo fortress. After that, no other combat deaths have been recorded in the history of the Swiss Guard. This weekend sees the anniversary of that sacrifice by the guards, which is marked on this date with the annual swearing-in ceremony of all new recruits to help remind them of the seriousness of their commitment. The recruits are all Swiss Catholics of irreproachable character and serve for a minimum of 25 months. They must all be single and age between 19 and 30. Each recruit also has completed rigorous entrance requirements and Swiss Army training. In addition to their military prowess, the guards need considerable reserves of patience to cope with the endless questions coming from the army of tourists who visit the Vatican each day. Two of the most common questions put to them are, "Why can't I see the Pope?" and "Which way to the Vatican museums?" Move! A unique feature of the Swiss Guards is their main weapon, the halberd. This is a weapon that looks like an axe with a spear at the top, and it sits on a long pole. The other distinctive feature of the guards, particularly their colourful ceremonial dress of blue, gold and red striped bloomers, that makes them one of the most popular snapshots by tourists at the Vatican. The other distinctive feature of the guard is their uniform, particularly their colourful ceremonial dress of blue, gold and red striped bloomers, that makes them one of the most popular snapshots for tourists at the Vatican. But just to put the record straight, this uniform was not designed by the artist Michelangelo, as is often thought. The actual designer was a commandant named Jules Repon, who designed them back in 1914, and the uniform's Renaissance styling is believed to have been inspired by Michelangelo's great rival, Raphael. That's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.